It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Film lovers, welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Busy show today. McKenna Mays, the film sociology correspondent this semester, will be talking with Candy Beard, who is the assistant director of the Dreams Come True Film Festival, which is down in Terre Haute, and that is happening in June, but we're planning ahead on this one. She's going to talk about the festival and the history of the festival and how one gets to be a part of a festival. And a little later on, I have a lively chat with Jeff Marker, who is a film critic for the Daily Film Fix, as well as the chair of the film department at the University of North Georgia. And I have to vent at him. So you get to hear part of that. Aren't you lucky? All right. Well, we are in the post-Oscar period where, the Oscar movie, the Academy Awards are done. Most of the films that are up or won are now available on video for the most part, and now we're just waiting for, I think, Solo. That's the first big film of the summer, which, of course, will come out in May. That being said, opening this weekend, I watched Tomb Raider. And at the very least, Tomb Raider is intriguing because Alicia Vikander, Academy Award winner Alicia Vikander, is a star. The question, of course, goes, did we need a reboot? But we're not the ones who say that. It's the studios. But I do like Alicia Vikander. She's had quite the career here in the States. Everything from Testament of Youth, Ex Machina, which got her probably the most notice in the States at that time. And then appeared in everything from The Man from U.N.C.L.E. to Burnt. She did the film Jason Bourne, so it's not her first foray into action. Of course, she won an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress for The Danish Girl back in 2015. She was in Tulip Fever last year, and now she is playing young Angelina Jolie. She's playing Lara Croft. And this is also from the Norwegian director Roald Othag. I hope I'm saying that right. Best known here in the States for his film The Wave from 2015. So what we have is a young Lara Croft, the daughter of a missing explorer, a very rich explorer, who she doesn't want any of the family's money. He's been dead. He's been gone, perceived dead for many, many years. It's a simple matter of her signing over the business to herself. But she finds, of course, a puzzle, a clue that could lead to her father, the finding of her father on a remote island outside of Japan. And of course, there's a tomb that needs to be, if it's opened, bad things will happen to the world. And that's the gist of it. Tone-wise, this is darker and more serious than the Angelina Jolie Lara Croft films because she's young. She's still finding herself. She's working as a bike food delivery person instead of jumping into the boardrooms of her father's company. It should also be noted, Dominic West is playing her father, Walter Goggins, who gets to have some fun as the villain. And you also have Kristin Scott Thomas and Derek Jacobi, who don't get to do a whole lot in this film, but they're already priming this for a sequel, and I got a feeling they're going to be doing a lot more. And kudos to Daniel Wu, who plays a shipman who becomes Lara's companion. Action-wise, yeah, the action scenes are a little too busy for me. And then, of course, once we get on the island where the tomb is, the film does literally turn into a – well, not literally. It does turn into a video game, which is what this character is based on in the first place. Vikander's good. And I think at the very least you can watch and see what stunts she was doing and then what stunts were either CG or done with a stunt person. But she, you know, gives it all her all in this. A lot of grunting and gasping. I don't think there's been this much cinematic gasping and grunting since Sandra Bullock in Gravity. It's again, and it's too long. I think it's probably you could probably snip at least 20 minutes off of this picture, which is running just a couple minutes shy of 2 hours. But if you like her and you like the series, I guess you get a prequel, I guess, or an origin story, I guess, on that part. But it's okay, just not offensive. But then again, I think most of the remakes, do you remember the remake of Point Break? Do you remember the remake of Fright Night? I do, because it was the darkest 3D film I had seen, not in tone, but in actual darkness and light. And you'll hear me gripe about a remake that the curiosity got to the worst of me. And I saw it earlier this week, even though it's been out for a few weeks. You'll hear that with my Jeff Marker conversation in a little bit. Okay, moving on to the calendars of some road trips we're taking. Of course, if you're listening on Saturday at 3 o'clock at IU Cinema, the underappreciated Robert Altman film Three Women, starring Sissy Spacek and Shelley Duvall. Eve's Bayou, a great underrated film from 1997, is at 7 p.m. Sunday the 25th, the 1959 Western Ride Lonesome, and then at 6:30 p.m., the National Theater live production of Follies. Monday, March 26th, here's your Monday matinee classic from 1940, one of the funniest films ever made, one of the fastest comedies ever made, His Girl Friday. And then at 7 p.m., The Bothersome Man from 2006. Tuesday, March 27th at 7 p.m., the documentary biofilm Bombshell, The Hedley Lamarr Story. That's Hedley. Friday, March 30th at 6:30 p.m., Robert Altman's The Player. And at 9:30 p.m., just added the 2017 Academy Award-winning Best Foreign Film, A Fantastic Woman. And then Saturday, March 31st at 3 p.m., oh, man, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. I have, and at 7 p.m., A Fantastic Woman, in case you missed it on Friday the 30th. I have mentioned before, and I will say it again, that the original film version of Inherit the Wind, which is Spencer Tracy and Frederick March, for me is the cinematic equivalent of a boxing match, like a heavyweight title match. The undercard match would be Shatner Montauban. There you go. Over at the historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin on March 23rd and 24th at 2 and 7:30 p.m., the original Never-Ending Story. I think a good kids' adventure film, visually too creepy for my daughter, but she's of a different era. April 6th and 7th at 2 and 7:30 p.m., the great film, and Emma liked this one much, much more, the great All About Eve. And then April 13th and 14th at 2 and 7:30 p.m., Napoleon Dynamite. Drive-ins are open in March, ladies and gentlemen. Aren't we lucky for it? And it just depends on how warm it is. On screen one at the Tibbs, Black Panther and Proud Mary. Screen two, Winchester and Death Wish. Screen three, Tomb Raider and Game Night. And screen four, Peter Rabbit and Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle. Meanwhile, at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville, Tomb Raider and Game Night. There you go. Okay, some Blu-ray titles of note. Let's see. Shape of Water, of course, which won Best Picture, and a few others. Call Me by Your Name, which won Best Screenplay. Ferdinand, which was up for Best Animated Film. The Disaster Artist, nominated for Screenplay Adaptation. I, Tonya, of course, Allison Janney won for Best Supporting Actress. Justice League is out. Better than Batman Superman. That's about it. Batman versus Superman. And then Criterion, finally. This is cool. Martin Scorsese's The Age of Innocence, an underappreciated Martin Scorsese film. All right, ladies and gentlemen, here is McKenna Mays the film sociology intern, talking with Candy Beard, the assistant director of the Dreams Come True Film Festival in Terre Haute. Enjoy.
Hi, Candy. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. You ready to get started?
I am.
All right. So I want to start with how the film festival itself got started.
Okay. Well, we got started in June of 2016 after we had attended a film festival. I won't say where, but it was the second year that we had attended there. And even after the first year that we attended, we had a couple of films screened there, and we realized a lot of things that we felt they were doing wrong. And still, the next year, I submitted to them again, thinking, well, you know, it was just one time. We'll give them another chance. So we did the following year, and we had two more films in their festival. And my son, Daniel, and I, he's a director, and I'm the co-director. And so after the second year, we talked about it a lot more. And we said, I don't remember which one of us said it, but one of us said, you know, we could do a lot better than that, you know, if we were running a film festival. And so we had about a three-hour drive or so on the way home, and we just started putting our heads together and taking a lot of notes. And the next thing we know, we're naming our festival and getting started. So it basically just came out of being really disappointed with some of the festivals that we had seen in person, and we wanted to do a better job, and we just felt like that we probably could, so we thought we'd give it a shot.
Okay, and because you guys are fairly new, have you faced any struggles trying to get it started and up and going?
I would say the biggest struggle for us is just getting our name out there, because we're primarily known as a film production company. We've been in the business since June of 2011, and so people just know that we make movies. And so I would say our biggest struggle is just getting people to realize that we're not only filmmakers, but that we're also film festival directors. And just trying to, you know, grow that. Like you said, we're only in year two, and we're just trying to build up a reputation and, you know, get more people to realize that we do exist.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And I know you talked about film festivals that maybe got it a little wrong, but have you been inspired by some film festivals?
To be honest, you know, we work so much. We make films just nonstop, and we've been doing that since 2011. So we haven't really been able to travel to a whole lot of festivals. The ones we have done, you know, they were okay. We were probably more inspired by the ones we were disappointed in, and that might sound weird to say, but sometimes, you know, you're just more inspired by something that you don't like about something, and you just want to do better.
What would you say makes your festival unique?
Okay, so what makes us unique, I think, is, for one thing, the pricing. Many film festivals, they start their film entry fees at $50 and go well over $100. And so we decided when we started this festival that we were going to be affordable. I believe we started out with just $10 entry fees, and then, of course, with every new deadline, it goes up a couple dollars. But throughout the whole process, from beginning to end, we keep our fees very, very low, because we understand that once you've come out of production, oftentimes there's not enough money in the budget to start entering film festivals. And so we want people to be able to afford to enter our film festivals. We don't want to put a financial burden on people. And yet film festivals can be such an exciting time for filmmakers. And so, yeah, we are unique in the fact that we keep our prices very, very low. And another thing that makes us unique is that we do not put a time clock on completion dates, meaning that while most festivals say that your film has to have been completed within the past year or even just 2 years, we go beyond that. We say there's no time clock on completion dates. So even if your film was completed 5 years ago, 7 years ago, or 10 years ago, we welcome you to submit to our festival, because either filmmakers get busy after one project, they dive straight into another one, which we're guilty of. We do that all the time. and then your film festival entries just get put on the back burner and you just don't have time to enter, or maybe you don't have the funds to enter after you've just finished a production. So those are the two things I think that make us the most unique.
Mm-hmm. And with the submissions that you do get, do you usually get like a variety of genres?
We do. We are open to all genres except, of course, pornography. We always stipulate that. We encourage student films, and we've had some student films screened last year. We also encourage ultra-low budgets because we've found that even ultra-low budget films can be great films. Personally, for me, I like drama, and anything that makes me cry is a winner in my book, whereas my co-director, he loves the horror films and psychological thrillers. And I do want to say this, you know, Dreams Come True Films, the production company, is a faith-based company. And I've actually had people message me and say, hey, I know your production company is a faith-based production company, but what about your film festival? Are you only looking for faith-based films or Christian films? And the answer to that is no. We are not strictly looking for faith-based. I mean, while those are great, we encourage all filmmakers who feel like they have a great film to showcase, we encourage all of them to submit. Just so long as we don't get pornography, we're happy with that.
So this is really a film festival that's open for everyone?
Absolutely. Open to everyone and to all budgets.
All right. And how did you originally get involved with film?
I became a writer back in 2005 because my youngest son was bullied in school. And after 7 years of putting up with that, I took him out of school and began to homeschool him. And I wrote a very, very short book. I think it was like 20 pages. And it was about bullying in school. And I self-published that. And I just kept going, writing book after book after book. And then the next thing I know, I'm writing screenplays. And then in 2011, I was invited to visit some filmmakers out in Sherman Oaks, California, where they had purchased one of my short films, and they were producing it. And the filmmaker invited me to come out and be on set while they produced the short film. And I was able to do that along with my husband and my son, Daniel, who I partnered with. And we spent 5 days out in California. And when I came home, I told my husband I was just absolutely in love with the idea of making films. That was in March of 2011. I started my company in June, and we started working on our first film in September. So it all started with, you know, me trying to change things for bullying for my youngest son, and it's just exploded from there.
And what was your first production with your new film company?
It was a film called In a Cage, and it was a feature film about domestic violence. And I based it on real events. When I was a teenager, I lived with my mother and my stepfather, and he was very abusive to my mom. And so I wrote the film about what I witnessed as a teenager, seeing my mom abused almost daily.
So you've really been able to turn these kind of hard times in your life into something that's creative.
I have. I've been able to make something very negative into something very positive, and I feel really blessed about that.
That's great. What was the process kind of like of you making your first film?
Oh, wow. Well, the first thing I had to do, of course, was find the cast, and I was very new at that. Didn't really know what I was doing, but another filmmaker friend of mine had told me about Film Indiana. And so I went to Film Indiana website and posted a casting call and a call for crew, and I just started the casting process and looking for locations. And it all happened very, very quickly. I think I started that process in July, and like I said, we were in production in September, and we wrapped in November. And you know, it was just, like I said, very fast, but I thoroughly enjoyed the process. And I keep learning something new with every film, and it's just been great.
You've actually written 16 feature film screenplays?
Yes, I have.
Do you have one that's maybe, like, been most popular?
The most popular has been our romantic comedy, which actually we just finished up last summer, and we premiered it with a red carpet premiere on November the 4th. And I'm really happy to say that last month we actually signed a contract with an international sales agent and distributor for that film, and also a film that we finished in 2014. But what I was going to say about the most popular film, the romantic comedy, it's called The Promise, and we're real excited about where it might end up going. So.
Are you working on any projects right now?
Not really. I promised my husband when we wrapped up production last summer that I would take 2 years off and just, you know, kind of rest up and concentrate on family and distribution of our previous film. So I'm trying to keep that promise, but at the same time, you know, there are a list of things that Daniel and I have to do for the what they call the delivery process in our distribution. And so we're keeping busy doing things like that for our distributor. And, of course, looking forward to our red carpet premiere of another film that we wrapped up last summer. It's called A Second Chance, and it premieres next month. And then, of course, the film festival coming up in June. So we are super busy right now. So I really don't have time to work on another film production right now.
Mm-hmm. And your submission deadline has actually passed, and now people are going to be notified on April 1st. How are they kind of being contacted?
We contact everyone individually, of course. Well, first of all, Film Freeway makes it really easy. And once we do our part, Film Freeway sends everybody an email letting them know whether or not they've been selected or if they have not been selected. And then Daniel follows up with an email, because some folks last year would say, well, I didn't get anything from Film Freeway, so I'm so excited that, you know, you reached out to us. So they get contacted twice, and then, of course, we keep our Facebook page very active. And so we post all the laurels on our Facebook page so people can go there and share on their Facebook pages as well.
Okay. My final question is, how can people attend the festival?
Okay. Well, the festival is June the 9th and 10th at the Hilton Garden Inn in Terre Haute. And anybody who wishes to attend can reach out to me via our Facebook page or contact me from Film Freeway. There's a contact me button on there as well. So I'm really easy to get a hold of, and we respond very quickly, and we'll be happy to let people know how they can attend. We have not started ticket sales and probably won't until a couple of days after everyone has been notified of their selection. So.
Okay. I lied. I actually have more questions.
Okay.
What is your, like, go-to movie night at home as a family?
Oh, man. Gosh. In my family, we all have pretty much different tastes. That's really just a hard question to answer because, like I said, we all like different things. And my husband's really not into movies at all, so I can't really get him interested in a film. But I like I said before, I like anything that stirs my emotions and makes me cry. If it makes me cry my eyes out, it's a real winner. So that's my favorite kind of movie.
Have you seen anything recently that you've liked?
Actually, I have not. I was talking to an actress last weekend, and she was saying, have you seen this and have you seen this? And my answer was, no, my goodness, I work so much. I'm so busy working, I have not had time to enjoy any recent films. But I've told her that after we wrap the red carpet premiere and the film festival, and I'm truly in my break period, I'm going to try to enjoy some films.
Film sociology correspondent McKenna Mays with Candy Beard of the Dreams Come True Film Festival in Terre Haute. That's June 9th and 10th. All right, here's my rant, my chat with Jeff Marker. Joining me on Film Sociology, I'm going to be honest, folks, he's a terrible human being. he is a hater of cinema. I don't know why he teaches film to children at the University of North Georgia. I hope he doesn't make them watch Dorothy Stratton films. I think it's just for me. But full disclosure, a buddy of mine and from college and a film critic, as well as a film professor, head of the chair of the department at the University of North Georgia, as well as a writer on the Film Fix, and just a bad guy. How are you, Jeff? that.
I'm fine. That is the best introduction I've ever had.
You've never had one.
Let me clarify.
Yeah.
Yeah, I never have had one like that. And let me clarify, I'm actually not allowed to show the students Dorothy Stratton films where I usually work.
You know what? The problem is there's hardly any nudity in Galaxina, so I think you actually could. It's just bad.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was we'll get there, right?
Right, we'll get there. So, okay, here's some background on our repartee. So, Jeff and I have known each other since college. Jeff grew up in the state of Ohio. I grew up in the state of Michigan. And because we like sports and film, it does happen, folks, we do an annual cinematic bet involving the Michigan-Ohio State game. And the loser has to watch the film selection of the winner. Well, if you've been following college football in the Midwest, I've been watching a lot of crap the last few, this decade, really. So
it's been a good run.
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't blame you. Maybe I should blame Jim Harbaugh and his stupid pants. But
and Brady Hoke before him, before him. Should we go on?
No, we should not. So the movies are bad enough. So I've had to watch things like Jack and Diane and the pirate movie and Strange Wilderness, and I got a double bill. He found two things on one Blu-ray. By the way, I have these on Blu-ray. So it's the pictures are much clearer, but I watched finally The Crater Lake Monster, followed by Galaxina, and I thought, why in God's name are these things put together? Besides the fact that I know you saw the headliner and that probably piqued your interest, but these are both Crown International Pictures, and if you want to go to Wikipedia and look up Crown International, you'll get the idea. It's borderline Mystery Science Theater material.
Right, and this is the kind of thing that neither you nor I would pass up in a store, because that's you know, the first thoughts that go through my head, of course, are, why are these two films on Blu-ray at all?
Right.
Why are they on Blu-ray together? It's such an oddity. They just need to take my money. You know, whether it ended up being sent to you or just was in my home in a prominent place. I don't know. It's just such a weird combination. I had to get it.
Yeah, I could hear the horns pointing out of your head when you saw this, I'm sure. The Crater Lake Monster is self-explanatory. Is invading, I believe, Southern California. It has this kind of sub Harryhausen visual effects.
That's a really nice description.
Well, we know those. I mean, you've seen Harryhausen's work, and then you've seen the ones that really want to be him, or it's like Bill Harryhausen,
right.
Jack Harryhausen. So, and yeah, it's written and directed by William Stromberg and stars Richard Cardell. A lot of people I've never seen since. I always go on IMDb and go, did these people do anything after this? No. Weird. Now, you didn't watch this, right? You have not seen these? I had to sit through this?
Oh, no, I watched them.
Oh, you did? Oh, well, bless your heart. Good. You
because
know my
I
pain.
I also, am a masochist, so,
But there's a couple of plot detours that really have no business being there. There's some comic relief that really doesn't need to be there, and a music score that's really distracting. I just watched The Aftermath, which also had a distracting soundtrack. I don't know why they plopped it on there, but they did. It's a mess.
It is. It is a mess. I think it's a sincere effort. By Mr. Stromberg and company. But, yeah, it's just one of those late 70s, early 80s awful movies that somehow got funded.
Yep. And I would say that's not even – that's the opening act. That's the bad company of this. Because then there was Galaxina, which we have talked a little bit on the show before. It is – the film that stars Dorothy Stratton, even though she's not really the lead, she's the most prominent – figure in the film. It's ripping off every sci-fi thing from the 60s through about the late 70s. There's a ship that's out for God knows how long, and she's basically she's Gypsy. she's a curvaceous version of Gypsy from Mystery Science Theater, if you think about it.
Yeah, I get that. I have to admit, at the outset, I did not make it all the way through Galaxina. I just remember feeling like I had sat there for maybe 3 hours and nothing had happened. People had barely even spoken to each other. It was just such an odd nothing of a movie.
It is one of the longest 90-minute films I've experienced in recent memory.
It is, and it's only 90 minutes. That tells it. You know,
yeah.
I can usually make it through. I made it through Crater Lake Monster, but I did not make it through Galaxy.
So there, yeah. So there's, you have Stephen Mocht, who I actually remember from Cagney and Lacey, and Avery Schreiber is the leader of this space police cruiser, and his character's name is Cornelius Butt with two T's. Yeah, that's the level we're going at, folks. There's little nods to Star Trek and Star Wars and Alien and 2001, and it just reminds you that all of those films are just heads and tails better than this. Oh, man. I mean, yeah. And so the real reason why we see this is because of Dorothy Stratton, because you and I are of a certain age. Anything that stars a Playboy centerfold, you might donate some time to it.
Yes, I got a big side eye from the wife when I picked this up, and, you know, like, yeah, I know why you're getting that. But yeah, I mean, and really, don't you think the only reason this thing ever got made is because they cast her, and she, like you said, she's actually not the biggest part of the movie at all, but she's the thing that people would have recognized when this was released in 1980.
Yeah, great poster, by the way. Pretty good.
Great poster, yes. Recalls Barbarella and a bunch of other things.
Yep.
Yeah,
a little bit of that.
That's how they're selling it. And then, you know, it was conceived in a marketing department, and not in a writer's room. Put it that way.
Yes. Yeah. The second half, because she doesn't say anything in the first half, and then she winds up developing more human type features. And yeah, folks, of course they go there. It's R rated, even though there's not a whole. I don't think there's any nudity. And by the way, I think this was the first time we saw a three breasted creature. So take that, Total Recall.
Oh wow. Okay, that's a landmark moment, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, thanks for sending me that. Yeah, and there's also a Western moment because they were shooting in Southern California and they were having fun with the color filters. I mean, it's really a slug to get through.
You almost get the sense that the crew, they kept going like as another production would end, but hadn't been torn down yet. They would just sort of this crew would show up and say,
yeah,
okay, what do we got? You know, how can we sort of mix it into the story here in some way?
Yeah, there's
the Western,
and there's a biker gang that shows up, and yeah.
Is there really? Jeez, I didn't even get there.
Yeah, no, of course, because I went all the way through this because Michigan lost, and so did I.
Yes, it is to your credit. Let me say publicly that you always make good on the bet.
Yeah, because I'm better than you.
you're
a miserable human being making me watch these.
you're just mad because you haven't won in about 100 years.
You're damn right I'm mad. I have so much cinema agony waiting for you, and it's just gathering dust.
It is. Yeah, I do recognize that, by the way. By the time Michigan finally wins, I'm going to hurt so bad, whatever you send me.
Because it's fun because Jeff has to find stuff. Yeah, because I believe my tolerance of bad cinema is a little stronger. My family has none of this.
No, your tolerance is a lot stronger.
Okay.
Let me just say.
Yeah, because I know he's actually called me on stuff. Have you seen this? Yes. Damn. I'll keep looking.
Yes. My wife and I...
Lady Macbeth.
Lady Macbeth, that's right, exactly. So that's what Matt calls her now. Because when I run out of ideas of things to send Matt, she has a real knack for coming up with really good ones. The pirate movie, I have to give her full credit for that one.
Oh, yeah,
I had never even heard of this movie.
That movie screams Linda Belcher. Yeah, I know. So
yeah,
if that wasn't enough, I sat through those two. And the other thing I have is occasionally I call Jeff for film therapy because I'm Dr. Soci, film therapist, but occasionally the therapist needs a therapist. So if I'm Lorraine Bracco, that makes you Peter Bogdanovich.
Yes, I will be that.
Film sociology reference. But I have a tendency to let my curiosity get the best slash worst of me. And normally it's like November, December when I think, I haven't seen, how bad can this be? I think I need to pad up my worst list, the worst films of the year list. Well, two things happened. I need to consult with Jeff on this. So because I watched a film starring Dorothy Stratton, it's not even the best film about Dorothy Stratton. Ladies and gentlemen, after watching Galaxina, I watched Star 80.
Oh, good Lord.
Let's see. How should I put this? It's an excellent film. I did shower afterwards, literally, literally and figuratively. This is Bob Fosse made five films: Sweet Charity, Cabaret, All That Jazz, this one, and Lenny. All of them deal in one way, shape, or form with the kind of seedy underbelly of show business and or fame. Star 80 is the seediest of them all, and he made Cabaret that involved Nazi Germany.
Yeah. Yeah, it really does kind of make All That Jazz look like a nice community theater troupe, doesn't it?
Yeah. Star 80 was his last film. And it is a story we had heard of. It's the story of Dorothy Stratton. Mariel Hemingway, of course, plays her, and creepy Eric Roberts is. I remember when that film came out and I saw it, I had to find interview footage of him so I could see him as something else. It's that effective.
Yeah, and I remember encountering most of the movies you're tossing out here, during the cable era. You and I both came of age when, around what, late elementary, middle grades, we were all getting cable. And I don't know about anybody else, but my parents didn't understand that HBO isn't like the networks. It doesn't wait until 9 to show the adult stuff. And so HBO and Cinemax, they would just show these things all day, and I was scarred for life. And that's why I'm in film studies.
Yeah, that we're all grateful for both of those things.
Right. But I remember, All That Jazz and Star 80 were very similar experiences. You think, okay, this is going to be kind of risque. Is it going to be? No. It was not what I was looking for at all at age 12.
At least, well, you were a 12-year-old that had at least you had a moral compass, I guess. That's.
Yes. Okay. Sure. We can spend it.
Well, the big punch on this was for guys our age was Mariel Hemingway was going to be nude in this film. I mean, we were teenagers, we were middle schoolers. That's what we heard. We knew it was the Mariel Hemingway gets naked movie, and because certain guys I know I had kind of developed a crush on her after watching Manhattan.
Sure.
And so there are a number of films where they kind of push that, like, there's so-and-so is going to be nude in it. And you go see it, and it's not the Playboy, ironically, it is not the Playboy romp one expects when they're 12 or 13. In fact, Mr. Fosse, first scene, is going to show you, this is not Yaha time.
Right. And just before anybody condemns our entire generation, they did the same thing with that movie that they did with Swordfish, if you remember. They made a big deal about Halle Berry, right?
Yep, the $500,000 shot.
Exactly. So, that's how they sold it. And, of course, we were suckers at that age, and we went for it. But it's a little bit – it's kind of like Boogie Nights in the sense that if you're looking – like it's part of that world, so it has the sheen of sexiness, but that's not what you're going to see, And so it sort of shines a mirror in a way. I don't know if this is what Fosse intended or not, but I just remember it sort of shining a mirror on your own depravity.
Yeah, I think that. I mean, that's I remember when I don't know if you saw Magic Mike in the theaters. I did, and I was one of few guys, and there were ladies that I know that took off work to go see this, and as I was leaving the theater, they were kind of mad, and I think part of it was they wanted the strip club experience without the late night, the drink cover, and the walk of shame, and mm-hmm. what they got was Steven Soderbergh's Boogie Nights. The story of a 30-year-old male stripper is not all it cracks up. It's kind of like being a 40-year-old Hooters waitress.
Right. Yeah, nice analogy.
Thank you.
I should read more about Fosse. This makes me intrigued about the man.
Well, and it's similar to, I mean, this and Lenny are his quote-unquote biopics, and they're similar that there's a lot of testimony and voiceover and non-linear. I mean, we start with the act itself, the death, the murder-suicide, spoiler alert on a 35-year-old incident. But yeah, it's it was interesting to read about, because names had to be changed. The filmmaker, it's so not Peter Bogdanovich, and the film is so not They All Laughed, but it, you know, if you read up on it, you know that it is. But yeah, I'd love right. to. I think Criterion should do all of Fosse's films, but that's just me. At least at the very least for the research.
Yeah, and this, I mean, it does strike me though, because you're talking about two different viewing experiences here. You know, Star 80, you know, Fosse knew how to make a film. He was a competent storyteller, and so I would imagine most of that is intentional. It's not what you get with the movies that you and I tend to send each other every year.
So because of that, I had to cleanse my palate. Normally, folks, when you have a streak of bad movies or so fun it's bad movies, then you have to watch something the complete opposite to cleanse your palate. And I did, but it was Star 80. So I don't recommend that to anybody, really.
That was not wise.
That was not wise, but I did it anyway. Now, there was one other curiosity thing that got the best / worst of me. And part of the reason why was because I've been reading up about it, about the history of the story. And frankly, I was 20 minutes away and I went and saw it. Jeff Marker, why did I go see Death Wish?
I'm not sure I can answer that for you.
I think that was rhetorical.
Yeah. Maybe you still buy Bruce Willis as an action hero?
No, we went back. I think I've done this on a couple of occasions where I go to the IMDb page and go, when did Bruce Willis stop caring? And I think it's Sixth Sense. I think the length of my marriage has been why. But
listen, that's a known you know, title and intellectual property.
Right.
We kind of get in the strange thing is it kind of is the right social context for the right kind of Death Wish revival.
Yes.
And if you really think about it, there could be some fine social commentary, but I think they already did that with Harry Brown a few years ago.
Yeah, but nobody saw Harry Brown. You and I did.
Everybody go find Harry Brown.
Yeah.
If you're interested in like vigilante, you know, the sort of crabby old man who's tired of society and does something about it, but then raises all sorts of ethical issues, you know, I mean, that movie pretty much nails it.
Yeah.
It's Michael Caine.
It is Michael Caine. Yeah, I do. Yeah, there was, because they tried to push it. It was the post Liam Neeson, let's get old guys kicking butt. And it's Harry Brown is much, much more than that.
Well, let me ask you about Death Wish, because I'm
sure.
Not going to see it. So thank you.
Yeah.
You see movies, so they don't have to, right?
Right.
So, I mean, is there any of that social commentary, or is this just a sort of I've you know, had enough, and now I'm going to shoot people kind
right.
of movie?
No, it's well, I think one of the reasons why I watched it, besides the you know, like I said, the convenience of it, but I had read somewhere that in the early development stages of the original Death Wish, are you ready? Apparently, it was going to be directed by Sidney Lumet and star Jack Lemmon.
Oh, I would watch that.
Right? But then,
yeah.
Apparently, when Dino De Laurentiis came on as producer, both of them bailed.
Well, yeah.
So, I mean, now that would be an interesting idea. I know in the novel, which eventually I think I'm going to break down and go buy and read it, you know, because in the novel, he's an accountant. And then in 1974, my favorite cinematic architect, Charles Bronson, and then, of course,
pause for effect.
You know what? You're going to take the papers if they're coming from Charles. In this one, Bruce Willis is a doctor. So there's a little of that. But yeah, that intrigued me. I thought you couldn't get. I would like to see a non-action star in Death Wish. I'd like to see Richard Jenkins or Bryan Cranston do Death Wish and make him an accountant. I don't pull the strings money wise.
Yeah, that's interesting. It strikes me as a very tone deaf movie too.
Well,
that was a
here you go, directed by Eli Roth.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that turned me off.
And it's written by Joe Carnahan, of all people, who's, he hits and misses there. But this one, he's a doctor, so guess what? He saves lives. And they address this early on. There's a police officer who there's a shooting, and the cop dies, but the shooter is still alive, and he's got to go save him. And the cop's partner kind of bellows at him about saving this guy's life. So we got that set up. There's less of a moral dilemma, at least in the Charles Bronson version. The first time he shoots a guy, he goes home and he throws up. This one, Bruce Willis has trouble sleeping, but he winds up sleeping. Yeah.
Okay.
It also doesn't help that you're using AC/DC's Back in Black for training sequences and footage. And, you know, he is shooting more pale skinned people, I guess, take that for what it's worth. But no, it's kind of a slick action film, which goes, I think, against the moral dilemma that's from the novel and sort of in the original film.
Well, thanks for taking one for the team there.
Yeah.
I have no interest. You're not increasing my interest whatsoever.
No, I'm not. I know. And he's married to Elizabeth Shue, so that's not fair either.
Willis is married to Elizabeth Shue?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Which you know, we do the best. It's like I remember According to Jim. I'm like, 20 years ago, this isn't happening.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if we want to go on a tangent there, I recently, the family and I recently revisited another Elizabeth Shue classic, The Karate Kid.
Oh, jeez. I thought you were going to say Leaving Las Vegas.
No, right, yeah. We sat the 13-year-old down. We watched Leaving Las Vegas. Come on, what are you? Come on, who am I?
You're not me. I know. So do you buy in the theory that Daniel's the bully in the story?
I don't, but it's a confusing morality they are showing us in that movie, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, elaborate.
Well, you know, this is not what we want to teach kids these days, right? So you're being physically bullied, you're being beaten up. So how do you respond? Become better at beating up people, you know? But I got to say, I was reminded of what a natural Ralph Macchio was at that age.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm not saying he's, you know, Laurence Olivier or anything like that, but he just sort of commands the camera. He's very comfortable in front of it. Both he and Elizabeth Shue are. And, you know, it was interesting showing my son in his formative years a movie that came out during my formative years and just sort of pointing out, you know, some of the good things. But then here's some of the reasons why Daddy's messed up.
Like what? Sweeping the leg or?
Sweeping the leg, sure. But he provokes the guys, too, you know? Yeah. So yeah, he does bullyish things like with, you know, the hose over the bathroom stall and everything like that. That's not exactly, you know, the way that your therapist would tell you how to deal with bullying these days, is it?
Yeah, and apparently there's going to be a series. They're making a Cobra Kai series, and most of the people are involved.
Right, exactly. So I can't no way to remember the name of the main bully, the main Cobra Kai guy. But yeah, both he and Macchio are involved in some way. Who knows?
They have to address this, right? They have to at least allude to it.
You would think so.
Or at least Patton Oswalt's idea that the main bully is actually grows up and becomes the Gimp in Pulp Fiction. Have you not heard
That's
this?
Possible. No, I hadn't heard that one.
Oh, look it up. Patton Oswalt, Karate Kid, Gimp. Do it. Well, not right
okay.
now.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was 14, and when I saw it was from the director, it doesn't help that that film is pressed as from the director of Rocky. I went, yes, it's the Rocky of the 80s, whatever. I kind of dismissed it quickly.
But you can't deny it had an impact on our generation. I remember guys suddenly having those, you know, headbands that Mr. Miyagi gives Daniel and all of those kinds of things. This is a big movie.
Were you catching? Were you trying to catch flies with chopsticks?
Absolutely, I still do to this day.
And chop off beer bottles.
You don't do that?
No, there's these wonderful contraptions. They're called openers.
Oh, wow. Sounds new. Sounds exciting.
Speaking of bottle openers, this is how the conversation goes, folks. By the way, I forgot to make the dig on Death Wish. When Death Wish was supposed to come out last fall, but they wound up delaying the release because of the school shooting. And what happens a week after the film comes out? Yeah.
Bad call.
So, all right. So my other favorite cinematic moment involving beer tops. In Gran Torino, there's a scene where Eastwood finally buckles. The grumpy old man is slightly less grumpy, and he goes and has dinner over at the neighbor's house, who are of Asian descent, not his favorite. And the young girl, hands Clint a bottle of Tsingtao, fine Chinese beer. And he just, you know, twists it open and starts drinking. And I'm watching the film like, you know, I haven't had a Tsingtao in a while. So after the movie, no kidding, went to the liquor store, got a six-pack of Tsing, went over. Those are not twist-offs.
Just
the extra badness of the badassery of Clint Eastwood as an old man. He can twist off untwistable bottle caps. So take that.
Or it was just a bad property master.
Probably that.
The wrong kind of bottle.
Yeah, it was probably that. So, so what else have you inflicted on the kid?
You know, we let him drive in, you know, much of the time. And so we're watching all the superhero stuff. And so we just revisited Thor Ragnarok. Should I sound like a grumpy old man about that one for a couple of minutes?
Yeah, go ahead.
That movie's a mess. I remember last year people talking, you know, just sort of raving about it. It's just a mess. You know, they right as, you know, Hela comes, and now it's clear she's going to take over Asgard, and now we have this huge detour, and Jeff Goldblum keeps us entertained for a few minutes. But they crack jokes for 15 solid minutes while Asgard is being attacked back home. And so, yes, it's funny, and people tend to rate it very highly for the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but I don't get it. I'm gonna put up my black socks and say I don't like this movie very much.
Was it fun to watch Kate chew scenery?
Absolutely, that's the best part of the movie.
Okay. I have not gotten to it because the screening I had of the second Thor film, they messed up the film, and I just never got around to it. So I'm afraid I'm going to miss the subtle nuances. I think I'm going to have a Thor marathon sometime.
Yeah. Well, you know, to bring this conversation back to this week.
Look at you.
How remarkable is it that we had Black Panther and Wrinkle of Time 1 and 2 at the box office?
I know. It's, you know what? It's a bad time for the white males, you know, the oppressed, us.
Right, yeah, right. So many of us believe we are oppressed, right.
Yeah.
And I got to say, I really did not like the way that so many people covered those two movies as if they were in competition, because really, as someone who studies film history, teaches film history, this is a huge moment. This has never, ever happened in the history of American cinema to have two films, you know, written and directed by people of color primarily for that audience. In the case of Wrinkle in Time, primarily made for young girls, especially young girls of color. This is a big deal. You need to pause and appreciate it.
Okay, there we paused. So does this mean Tyler Perry has a movie coming out next week?
Oh, he'll come along and ruin it, won't he?
Well, I know what you're saying. Where you can't have more than one person of color in a top five, top two, top what have you. Did you see Wrinkle in Time?
I have not seen it yet. We may go this week.
Okay, you have to let me know. The post I saw, somebody referred to it as Annihilation for 9-year-olds.
Interesting.
So
okay.
I don't know. I'll have to check on that. So. Cool. So, I had in inflicting stuff on our children portion last week. I had time with Emma, and I said, "You pick," because I'm trying to get better at doing that. And she said, "I want to see something funny and from the '80s." And that opens it up pretty big. I showed her Heaven Help Us.
Okay.
Do you remember that?
It's coming back to me.
It is an underrated horny teenager film set in a boys' Catholic school in New York in the 60s. Your students are young Andrew McCarthy, young Kevin Dillon. The girl who runs the soda shop nearby is Mary Stuart Masterson. The head of the Catholic school is Donald Sutherland. You have John Hurd as the cool teacher. There's a cameo. There's a one scene monologue talking about lust at a school dance by Wallace Shawn. There's some school pranks and shenanigans, especially involving Catholicism, but it's got some heart. And it's 30 minutes shorter than a Judd Apatow film. So I go look for that.
I will. I have vague memories of this. It's been so long since I've seen it, but yeah. I do remember some scenes, and I remember liking Wallace Shawn in it a lot.
Yep. And I would say what's the randiest thing the kid has watched?
That I know of. Here's a good story. So there's a restaurant in Athens, Georgia that we like to go to, and it's called Clocked. You know, the kid, it's a little bit too greasy for the missus, and so there are times when she's involved in things, and so the kid and I will have a, you know, father-son outing, and we'll go to Clocked.
Right.
And it's a quirky little Athens place. There's ironic T-shirts everywhere. And they always have, you know, something playing on this TV above the counter. And usually it's, what is that, Mega Man, and, you know, the like Thunderbirds sometimes.
Oh, the Japanese puppetry series?
Yeah, exactly. But one day, they were showing In Like Flint.
Really?
And bear in mind, this is when the kid's like 8 years old or so, you know, and we're sitting there, and he's, of course, glued to it, because who wouldn't be?
Right.
Yeah, so that's probably the naughtiest thing. And I remember there's not all-out nudity in that, movie. But there are really close moments, and so I remember feeling a little bit like a bad dad.
Oh no, no, you're not that. First off, it's not Matt Helm, so you're gonna do your Bond knockoffs. No, and how old's the kid now?
He's 13.
Yeah, I might hold out on Heaven Help Us. I would revisit that by yourself first, and then go to other stuff.
Absolutely, I do remember enough about it. You know, that you jogged my memory that, yeah, not quite.
But really cool soundtrack. That's another one I thought, this is the reason why I took forever to get it on video, because of the song rights.
All right. I'll put it on the list.
Cool. So I guess what was the most recent thing you and the missus watched?
Like with the kid not around? You
sure.
Mean? Like
yeah.
Grown-up fair?
Yeah, grown-up fair.
You know, that rarely happens, actually. I've been busy watching, if I can plug something.
Go
here.
Right ahead.
I've been busy evaluating films. We're getting ready. We host a festival every year in May called the Georgia Film Festival. And so we accept entries from around the country and around the world. And so we show some good things from elsewhere. But for the most part, we celebrate homegrown films and talent and organizations. And so for the last month or so, that's kind of consumed what I've been watching.
Okay.
Seen some really good stuff.
Cool. And where can people go for more information on the festival?
You can go to the Eventbrite page, look up Georgia Film Festival on Eventbrite, or our official URL is gafilmfestival.com.
All right. Well, Jeff, I appreciate the time and the venting, and God, I wish Jim Harbaugh would do something. I hope the recruiting class is really good this year, because I love you. This sucks, but I love you. So,
yeah. Well, I'll be on the lookout, and I'm looking forward to late November.
Awful, awful human being. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks for having me on.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
believe you've let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!